This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. Senate Majority Leader Harry Reid says a bipartisan deal has been reached, a deal that would avoid a U.S. default and it would end the partial government shutdown. Speaking on the Senate floor, Reid thanked Republican leader Mitch McConnell for working out the agreement, an agreement to reopen the government through January 15th and increase the nation's borrowing authority through February 7th. Now, though the deal is in place, the House and Senate still, of course, need to vote to approve the legislation. Joining us now is Michigan Democratic Senator Debbie Stabenow. And, Senator, with this deal on the table, a new deal, how likely is it, do you think, from where you sit in D.C., that this deal is it, that the crisis is being averted?
Well, I believe that this will, in fact, get fixed, at least for the short term. But it certainly has not been without a tremendous amount of reckless and irresponsible behavior. You know, Cindy, we should never have been in this position. My focus is on manufacturing jobs, not creating manufactured crises, which is what has happened here. This should never have happened.
Since the shutdown began, I've been talking to your colleagues, different members from Michigan's congressional delegation, and I've asked everyone the same question, and I want to put it to you as well. Is the system broken? Has D.C. stopped functioning as not just for this, but lurching from crisis to crisis?
We're in a situation where, and this, of course, is all insider, and I don't blame everybody, including my own family, looking at this and saying, you know, what are you talking about? But every 10 years, we rewrite the lines of the members of the House. In 2010, Republicans controlling much of the process across the country. The districts were written in a way where they are very, very Republican or very Democrat, which means the race is in a primary, and on the Republican side, with the birth in 2010 of the Tea Party, we now have a small group of very, very extreme people that have been controlling the elections in the Republican Party. So we've had a group of very, very extreme people get elected. Now, that can change. I mean, if mainstream folks stand up and say, we're not going to, you know, put up with this anymore, and we want people who understand in a democracy to govern, you have to listen to each other and work with each other, and that means you don't always get everything you want exactly when you want it, just like in the rest of life, whether it's our family or business or community, you have to work together. But, you know, if there are a group of folks, including the Speaker, that decides he's had enough, then we can govern. But if they continue to allow a small group to intimidate and threaten them, then I think we are in for a bumpy road.
Senator, when you talk to your colleagues on the other side of the aisle, are the folks who are more centrist from the Republican Party and in the Senate, are they frustrated with the far right?
Oh, there's no question in the Senate. I would say we have 98 out of 100 that are incredibly upset and frustrated. I give a lot of credit to Republican colleagues like Senator John McCain, who's come to the floor a number of times to chastise Senator Cruz and the fact that elections have consequences. You can't come in as a small minority and try to and shut down everything to get your way. So we have a very large group of people that want to get things done in the Senate the way the rules are set up. One person can have a disproportionate amount of influence, but we can. I mean, if the House of Representatives, when the first shutdown, had sent us the bill that they have enough votes to do in the House, we would have passed it immediately, and we would have the government open, and we would be paying our bills right now.
Finally, Senator, quickly, I do want to ask you about the farm bill. We've spoken about it with you on the program. It's a bill you've spearheaded. It's an important bill that makes up billions of dollars in federal spending. So it's been passed in the Senate, bipartisan support, but has gone nowhere in the House. So quick prediction, will the United States go yet another year without a new farm bill?
I think we're going to get it done. I've finally been able to get the Speaker to appoint conferees, which means that we have a group to negotiate with in the House for a final bill. We are meeting today, the bipartisan leadership on agriculture. This will be, I think, the one exception to the dysfunction of Congress. I'm not going to stop until we get it done.
Michigan Senator Debbie Stabenow, thanks for talking with us on Stateside.
Good to talk to you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. A recent news story out of West Michigan caught our eye. Three of the five men linked to the biggest meth bust in Michigan have been sentenced to federal prison. It all began with a traffic stop in Pawpaw, and that led police to discover more than 20 pounds of pure methamphetamine from the vehicle and from a pole barn in Van Buren County. U.S. Homeland Security believes methamphetamine is being smuggled into the country in hidden compartments of vehicles and then sold in West Michigan. And crime reports find Southwest Michigan counties top the state list for meth lab busts, while burns from explosions and spills from cooking meth are on the rise in Kalamazoo County, and meth cases crowd court dockets in Southwest Michigan. We wanted to shed more light on methamphetamine, and our next guest can bring us this story in an intensely personal way. Jen Servey founded the Collegiate Recovery Program while she was a student at the University of Michigan. Today, she's a substance abuse coordinator at the Michigan Ability Partners in Ann Arbor and is soon heading to Texas to continue work with the Collegiate Recovery Program. Most importantly, Jen Servey is a recovering meth addict. She has been sober since May 13th, 2006, and she joins us here in the studio. Welcome to the program, and I see your face kind of smile when I say that day. That was your new life, May 13th, 2006?
That was my ultimate surrender to the disease and the day of my new awakening.
And here you are working to help people from going down the path that you followed. Tell us when meth first entered your life.
It was late 1998, so that would make me, about 26 years old.
Mm-hmm.
I had tried other drugs in the past. I have a history of opiate usage. I've had tried alcohol early in my undergraduate years. I had some marijuana usage and had been able to put down all other drugs when they stopped kind of working for me or had some consequences from their usage. However, when the first time I tried methamphetamines, there was something completely different about it. The first time I ever tried methamphetamines, my brain literally lit up, and I knew that I never wanted to be sober again.
It was a different feeling than anything you'd felt.
It was.
Who gave it to you? How did it enter your life?
You know, interestingly, I had a friend that was working at a county jail there down there in Texas, you know, which kind of shows you the normalcy of the usage down there. She brought it over one night. I said no the first time she offered it. The second time she offered it, I did it. And I absolutely never wanted to sleep again.
Why?
I was one of those kids growing up that, like, I absolutely loved my life. Like, it wasn't that I used drugs to escape life. I used drugs to enhance my life. I had a hard time early on balancing, like, alcohol usage and my academic studies and the demands of my friends. So the first time I did meth, I thought, you know what? I can balance everything and never have to sleep again.
Is your thinking still clear, or what does it do to just the way you operate throughout the day while you're high on meth?
Well, the thing about it is as an individual, you think that your thinking is clear. But when the body stays up 8 and 9 days at a time, it can't possibly be functioning normally. The body needs to sleep at the end of the day. The body needs to eat, and it takes everything in your power to even sit down and have a meal. So when I was going 8 days at a time without sleep, maybe eating one meal a day, and usually those meals were based upon high sugar content, dehydration from not intaking many fluids, you know, surviving in Texas heat of like 100 degrees, my body wasn't functioning normally.
And were you going to school at the time? What were you supposed to be doing in your life at that time?
I was. I was completing, supposedly, the end of my bachelor's degree in sociology at Texas Women's University.
Wow. And how did that go?
Well, I, at the time, basically stopped going to classes because I thought that I was done. Simultaneously, my mother was getting, she had rheumatoid arthritis and was getting increasingly ill. And my family began to start calling me on a regular basis saying I needed to come home. And I stopped answering the phone.
Mm.
Yeah.
So what was the progression, Jen, as you were using? How long did you use?
I used until 2006.
So what led to that crash where you said, I have to stop? Because you did go to jail and prison, didn't you?
For sure. So I had many interventions. My first one came in 1999. Quickly, I got my first possession case. Mm-hmm. So immediately, I had the court system. I was drug screening for the court system 3 times a week. During that time period, I was still using and trying to fake out the court system, knowing that I would probably go to jail. I did a small time in jail on that one. I went to my first treatment center, did a 30-day treatment center during that time period, and it did not get any better. My mother passed away in December of 1999. I spoke at her funeral. Hi. I was on her bedside here in Michigan at Beaumont Hospital. Hi. And those consequences were not enough to make anything change. In fact, at that point, that was a tipping point that led me all the way into addiction, where I had the thought process of, if your mother died, you would use too.
Mm.
And during that time period, I caught 5 felony charges, all for possession of methamphetamines under a gram within the state of Texas in 4 different counties.
So you were leaving quite a wake of legal trouble in your, right, in your trail. And who were your friends? Who were the people in your life?
So my ultimate goal was to become the functional drug addict. Hmm. So I led a double life. I had the people that supported my drug habits. I had my father that was an enabler who supplied all the funding for this. I had also this other life of people who were like my bosses, my employers, because I was trying to go to work every day. And who knew nothing about my drug habits, except that the accidental, random, oh my gosh, I ended up in jail again.
Boy, I'm talking with Jen Servey, who today is with Michigan Ability Partners. She also founded the Collegiate Recovery Program while she was a student at the University of Michigan, sharing her experience of being a methamphetamine addict for many, many years. And it was not until May 13th, 2006 that she stopped using. So having begun in 98 and going to 2006, you had such a long stretch. And I suspect now that you've gone through the tunnel and you look back, you realize you're very lucky to be sitting here talking with us today.
I am.
Your father, you just said, was an enabler.
He was.
What did your father do? Your mother passed away in 99. So as you went through these years of meth addiction, what did your dad do that was wrong?
He understood nothing about addiction. And, you know, today he still struggles, I think, with a little bit about what recovery means. He could not stand to see his daughter incarcerated. You know, and I think he felt very helpless, and I think he felt very alone. And so, you know, he did a lot of things to orchestrate and manipulate, like move everything that I owned up to Michigan, you know, in order to thinking that that would control me and move me back up to Michigan. And all it did was it sent me to treatment here at Brighton Hospital. And I moved right back down and did everything under my terms.
Right back to Texas.
Yes, I moved exactly where to my source of my drugs were. I took my car, I took my dog, and I took $200, and I moved right back to Texas. And within 8 months, I was incarcerated for the last time. The thing that he finally did right was he listened to my attorneys that were also my bondsmen, and the very last time, they said, you leave her there.
And he did.
I no longer had a bond. May 13th of 2006, I was arrested in a very small county of Palo Pinto County, Texas. And I had 4 charges out of 4 counties and had just received my 5th. And I called and he said, no, I will not leave you there.
And that was the first time you heard that?
Yes. And the door slammed for the very last time.
So what did it take then? There's that date, May 13th, 2006. You had to own your illness. How did that happen?
I was on a payphone with my father in a really small county jail. And I said to him, fine, I'm an addict. And for the first time in my life, I heard my voice reverberate off the jail cell walls. And I believed it. And I stood up, and for anybody that's ever been in a county jail, they have this module that's like the toilet and the sink, and it's all together. And I stood up on the little toilet, and I looked in this little funhouse mirror, and my eyes no longer had a soul. And see, all this time I had always thought that I couldn't possibly be an addict because I thought I was a college graduate, which I later found out I wasn't because I stopped going to classes. Mm-hmm. Doesn't mean you get a degree. But I thought that I was a college graduate from a really good family and that these kind of things don't happen to somebody like me, that they only happen on TV. And the thing about it was they do. And for the first time in my life, when I saw the reflection of myself and I heard my voice say those words, I surrendered. And that's the first step in Alcoholics Anonymous.
And that was that all it took? Did you ever backslide? Did you ever use again? Or was that the end for you?
That was my moment of clarity.
And now you finally did graduate.
I did. I finally have completed my degree at a local university. But it wasn't until I applied here at U of M to the Master's of Social Work program that I even figured out I didn't even have a bachelor's degree. Mm. I finished a bachelor's degree. I completed an associate's degree. And then I came here to U of M to the social work program.
And in setting up the collegiate recovery program and working with Michigan Ability Partners, and now you're heading back to Texas to again, help people from going down your path. Explain why Southwest Michigan is the area with the most meth activity. We don't see as much meth activity as far as meth labs, and the court cases seem to be really concentrated in Southwest Michigan. What is it about producing meth that makes that happen?
Well, my feelings is, and this is just my opinion, mm-hmm. is that, for example, in Texas, the reason why meth became so popular in Texas is because it's really easy to produce methamphetamines in an area that's in a rural area. Meth smells really strongly when you produce it. It takes a lot of farming chemicals to make it. Mm. The government has really closed down on a lot of the amphetamines that you take to purchase to make it. You can't just make methamphetamines necessarily in the middle of your neighborhood. I mean, you can, but for example, when I was living in downtown Fort Worth, the kid across the street from me tried to make it in his house, and he blew up the next door neighbor's house. So when you try to do these things, more than likely, you're going to end up getting caught. It's really easy to make it in the middle of a farmhouse because the chances are the DEA is not going to come like looking for you, and the next door neighbors aren't going to know what they're even smelling.
So, in fact, we were talking about the television program Breaking Bad, which is going into its final season. Mm-hmm. But I think a lot of Americans who've watched that show had their eyes open. And you said you found it incredibly authentic.
It was very authentic. I mean, it was authentic down to the production, the way it was produced, the glassware that was made. I mean, to my experience. And I was thrown right in the middle of it. I mean, some of the experiences that I had in my last year out using scared me, but not scared me enough to be sober. I mean, and that was the point when I knew that I was in, and I had lost sight of being a functional addict, and I knew that I could go to prison for a really long time. And I didn't know how to stop using because the insidiousness of meth usage. Meth tells you it was telling me every single morning if I didn't get high that day, I was going to die.
Which is something you never got from marijuana or from alcohol or pills.
No. And it tells you that you can be so functional and so productive and get so much accomplished on it. And I think that that's why it really appeals to the college-age student. Because it shows you that you can get so much classwork done. You can study for hours and you can be so academically successful. So it appeals to the students who have all these academic pressures on them and to be the best and to achieve so much on a college campus.
How do you, Jen, as a counselor, as someone who works or tries to keep kids from going down the path you went on, how do you from the outside get them to where you were internally when you looked in that mirror in that county jail in Texas and saw you didn't have any soul left in your eyes? How do you get them there?
I can, number one, share my experience, strength, and hope. You know, a lot of what we've done with collegiate recovery is be able to form a community because, let's face it, university campuses are a place where it is the social acceptance and the social norm to use alcohol, to use marijuana, to use things like Adderall to be academically successful. So how do we show these students who maybe have this disease that it is cool to be on a Saturday afternoon and to go to, for example, the Michigan-Notre Dame game and not be obliterated? How do we form a community where it's a safe place for them to be sober? Well, we, number one, give them a place where they can be together. We, number two, show them a place where they can celebrate their recovery and have a fun time together. It's the same concept as a fraternity, basically. You know, where they have a place of like-minded individuals coming together. to celebrate their success. Because for these kids, it's not an option of going out and just having fun or maybe being hungover on Sunday morning. For these kids, it's life or death. But a lot of college campuses have a, you know, like work hard, play hard mentality. These kids don't have an option of that. Like, they can die if they go back out there. They don't necessarily have one more use of heroin in them. Kids are dying all over the state right now.
For the kinds of statistics that I was talking about at the beginning of this interview, Jen, how concerned do you believe we should all be about the meth problem in Michigan?
I think it's growing. I think it's growing. And I think, you know, the thing about it is heroin doesn't necessarily scream it's prevalent in Ann Arbor, but it doesn't necessarily scream that you can be hugely academically successful. You know, it's definitely on our campus, but this meth thing, I mean, for me, when I first found it, I was like, I can do everything now. This is awesome, you know? And so I think we should be definitely concerned with it because it's one of those drugs, too, that gets you hooked right away the first time. So these kids try it once, and now they can do all the partying they want to do, crease their four-day weekends to 5-6-day weekends, and be academically successful at the same time here at Michigan. We got a problem.
You're heading to Texas to continue your work with the Collegiate Recovery Program. What do you want to continue doing throughout your life because of your experience as a meth addict?
I think that this has been my journey. Like, I think that I was given this disease in order to do this work. Like, I wouldn't be as good at this work or have this opportunity if I hadn't gone through everything that I went through. And I learned a lot, you know, from making mistakes and from, you know, learning how to work with students that are 30 days sober and fresh on a campus. So now I get the opportunity to do it again. And I'm taking it kind of back to my home state. So this is the 360 about it all, because now I'm really taking it back to where I'm from. The other blessing about all this is I have been cleared by the Texas prison system to bring Alcoholics Anonymous back into the Texas prison system. I would not be sober today if I had not started working the 12 steps of Alcoholics Anonymous while I was incarcerated. So I'm really honored to be able to do that on the weekends down there too. And that wouldn't be possible if I didn't move back. So I think there's kind of a 360 about it all too. If I didn't go through everything I went through, I wouldn't get to keep going back down there. So I think I have kind of a gift for working with college students. So I'm kind of excited about it.
And so back at it. Jen Servi, a substance abuse coordinator with Michigan Ability Partners in Ann Arbor, but heading back to Texas where she'll be working with the Collegiate Recovery Program. And also now that we're here, helping incarcerated women with Alcoholics Anonymous as well. She stopped using meth and her life changed on May 3rd, 2006. Jen, thank you for sharing your story with us on Stateside.
Thank you very much.
On average, each one of us guzzles about 30 gallons of bottled water a year in this country. And there's a debate going on over bottled water or carrying around your own bottle, refillable, and filled with water from the tap. Writer Mark Kurlianchik dives into the subject of water in Our Magazine with his piece entitled Ebb and Flow, Demystifying Drinking Water. Digging into the debate of bottled versus tap water, let's start with tap. Where do Michiganders get their tap water from?
Mostly from Detroit sources, Lake Huron and the Detroit River. And so I spoke with the former head of the Detroit Water and Sewerage Department because when you think of the Detroit River, you don't actually it's not that natural spring, right?
Yeah.
But apparently the way that these that the sources are designed, they're deep down, they're away from industry. We have some of the best water in the world, quite frankly, right here in Detroit.
And I've always heard that, so that is true from
what
you found.
That is true, and it is because the source water is so good. Mm. I mean, think about the Great Lakes. I mean, nowhere else in the world has this abundance of fresh water.
What do you think is the biggest myth, Mark, in the bottle versus tap debate?
I guess the safety would be definitely a huge piece of it because, you know, so a lot of the anti-bottled water crowd, if we can just kind of generalize here, would say that bottled water isn't regulated, which makes it somehow unsafe. But there hasn't been any large-scale recall of bottled water due to any type of contamination or foodborne illness, basically in the history of the industry.
Okay. That's a pretty good track record.
Yeah, exactly. So you can be confident that what you're drinking is safe. The issue, I think, has more to do with cost because when you think about it, you know, so the average gallon of tap water, say from Detroit, is about a penny. You know, and seriously, it's a penny for a gallon of water.
Wow.
And the average, the latest running average for bottled water for a gallon is like $2.83. So yeah, it's not, you know, $2.83 for a gallon, that's not terrible. But when you compare it to what you have already coming out of your tap.
Yeah.
And to take that a step further, about 40% on an estimate, almost half is the same water that you're drinking out of the tap that's just been filtered and bottled and sold at a premium.
And it gives you convenience, but it also, as you alluded to, those plastic bottles are clogging up landfills.
Yeah.
And that is becoming a growing concern, I think, to people.
Yeah. And it's not just it's not just the actual cost that you pay at the market. I mean, it's the environmental cost.
Right.
Shipping all the bottled water. You know, it's a different distribution system.
The footprint
that costs gas. Yeah, the footprint.
Mm-hmm.
You know, to their credit, the bottled water industry has done a lot over the last decade. It's something like almost 50% of these PET plastic water bottles come from recycled sources. And I guess there's a huge demand for PET in the recycling industry. And they've taken some other steps, actually decreasing the amount of plastic that goes into one of those bottles. They used to take double the amount of plastic. So,
because I've heard people that I know that try to be healthy, and that is a concern. What am I getting when I'm
right.
What's leaching into my water?
Right. And that's something that, you know, that you have to think about. The key point of that, too, is that, you know, the industry isn't going to make these changes on its, you know, out of the goodness of their own hearts. Let's be honest here. You know, it's because consumers are demanding, you know, that our bottles be more environmentally friendly, and that, you know, we as consumers are becoming more environmentally conscious. And I think that's the most important aspect of this.
Mark Kurlianchik, diving into the subject of water, one more for our drinking game here. I was sipping our water. In the May issue of Our Magazine, his piece is entitled Ebb and Flow, Demystifying Drinking Water. Always fun to talk with you, Mark. Thanks so much.
Cindy.
You are listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. From interviews about our water to the latest in state politics to conversations with the artists and the musicians who are making their mark in Michigan, we talk about it here on Stateside. Today, during the fall membership drive, we are asking you to help pay for the commercial-free programs that keep you in the know and keep you entertained. Please call 888-258-9866 with your gift of $10 or $15 a month or a one-time gift of any amount, $5 or $5,000. It all helps to keep the shows that you value on the air. Call 888-258-9866 or pledge online at michiganradio.org. Here's Zoe Clark and Emily Fox to tell you more about the fall membership drive. If you live in the city or the suburbs and you travel to the country, maybe by a lake, what's the first thing that strikes you when the sun goes down? Well, it's probably the incredible show in the night skies. The difference between what city dwellers see every night when they look up in the sky and the same sky when you're on, let's say, the shores of Lake Michigan and Emmett County is unbelievable. And that's the magic behind the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. It's a 600-acre park along the shore of Lake Michigan near Mackinac City, and it's one of only 10 designated dark sky parks in the entire world. Joining us from Emmett County is the program director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park, Mary Stewart Adams. A pleasure to have you on Stateside.
Thanks for having me, Cindy.
Tell us, what does it take for a place to be designated as a dark sky park?
Well, it takes a lot of community commitment and interest. And in Emmett County, what happened was because this particular piece of property was owned by the county and it was used as a public park, it required the Emmett County commissioners making a decision to say, yes, we recognize that the night sky is a resource that we would like to protect. And they did unanimously support the initiative to go then to the International Dark Sky Association, which is the longest standing nonprofit organization dedicated to protecting the night sky. And they're located in Tucson, Arizona. Now, this organization has set up the criteria that says, all right, if you'd like to be designated as a dark sky park or place according to our criteria, here's what you have to do to get that designation. And it required creating a lighting ordinance about the property that was more strict than the existing lighting ordinance in the county. It also meant doing a lighting inventory of any existing light on the property, bringing it into compliance, writing a master lighting plan, getting a lot of the community leaders and stakeholders to write letters of support, and then to have ongoing educational programming that's accessible, that's free, and the ability for folks to come any time of day or night and to witness this wonderful wilderness.
So it's a 24/7 park, so you can come at 2 in the morning and enjoy.
Absolutely, especially because sometimes the best night sky things are happening in the wee hours. Mm. So it's really lovely that the county provides this opportunity for the public to come and have access to the shoreline at night. Because oftentimes when you're on public land along the shore, you have to, at dusk, you've got to get off the property, but not at the headlands. You can come out. So, for instance, when the meteor showers are peaking, it's usually after midnight, and you can be there to watch it.
Long before the headlands became a designated dark sky park, you had a dream of finding a place to give people a chance to really see the stars. What is behind your love of the stars and wanting to share the stars with others?
You know, I have to say that in me, it dawned as an awareness that we were losing our, you could call it our cultural memories, because we live, most of us, in fact, almost two-thirds of the residents of the United States now live where they cannot see the stars of the Milky Way at night. And I don't know if you're like me. In my early childhood education, I didn't receive any instruction about basic constellation identification or the stories from indigenous peoples connected to those stars, to those constellations. So if you put these two things together, that we're not seeing it, nor are we any longer naming it for our youth, then you can see that we're losing something that's been very important for the cultural history of humanity since the beginning of time. And so with my English literature degree from college and my interest in the night sky, I really, over the years, developed a passion for telling the stories of the stars in a way that would give the common person, the non-astronomer, the person who doesn't own a telescope or a laser pointer, access to the stories of the night sky, because there's a certain amount of, not really fear, but a lack of courage about being able to encounter the night sky and its stories and be all right with doing that as a non-astronomer.
Right. I think we, you're very, very correct, Mary, that we don't get it in school. Most of us can say, well, I can pick out the Big Dipper and the Little Dipper and call it a night.
Yeah.
and so we really are losing an awful lot. But I think you're right. There's an intimidation factor. And you think it's so heavily scientific, I'll never get it anyway. And what am I missing?
Right. Right. And it's also not to diminish the science, because we have made some fabulous discoveries. But when you look at the history of humanity, you can see that some of the highest achievements in architecture, in art, in literature, and in science, the highest achievements are always out of this same striving to understand what is our relationship as human beings on the earth to this celestial environment in which we find ourselves. And so what I try to do is give voice to the artist or the architect or the humanities type person who's also living and working in that environment. And while you might not have access to a deep sky telescope that's going to show you the 900 million objects that aren't visible to the naked eye, there's still a bridge that was built through this art, through this architecture, through the poetry, the mythology, the literature, even through some of the classical stories that come out of the Bible, all the sacred texts of the many religions. And it's just thrilling to hear those stories under the same sky and find yourself in a dark environment where you can see what was also being seen when those things were created.
If you've just joined us, this is Stateside from Michigan Radio, and we're speaking with the program director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park in Emmett County, right there on the shores of Lake Michigan, Mary Stewart Adams. And Mary, you say it's a part of your job to speak up for Once Upon a Time. Can you give us an idea of the kinds of stories that you feel are, it's very, very important for us to be able to be in touch with our ancient roots?
Well, I think that because I'm up here in northwest lower Michigan, one of the most important things are the stories that belong to the tribe that's indigenous to this area. And what we have at Headlands is a virtually untouched old growth forest. So there's a very rich history in this place, the Anishinaabe and the Odawa, who inhabited this area for thousands of years before the first Europeans came. Their stories are very important to us. But then every culture around the world has its star stories. So the Once Upon a Time for me is really about being able to say, look at these well-known fairy tales or these well-known nursery rhymes or these mythologies and these moral lessons that come out of every culture. They're actually rooted in the stars. One that I love to tell, particularly in the month of May, because it's very well known, is the nursery rhyme, Hey Diddle Diddle. Every object that's named in that particular nursery rhyme belongs to a constellation that's visible overhead in the month of May. And most people have the idea that, yeah, that might have something to do with the stars, but it's really quite specific. The cat is Leo the lion. The little dog is Canis Minor. The dish that runs away with the spoon is a direct reference to the Milky Way. So you find this delightful relationship to the stars behind just about everything that has a historical or cultural significance in our history.
You caught us there. We're all going, who knew? That...
Oh, there's plenty more. Mother Goose is filled with it. In fact, it's old Mother Goose, when she wanted to wander, would fly through the air on a very fine gander. Well, that gander is connected to the constellation Cygnus, the swan, which is sometimes referred to as the Northern Cross, that can be seen flying along the Milky Way all throughout the summer months. And it's really beautiful to be out under those stars and reciting those rhymes, those nursery rhymes, those stories. That's the once upon a time that's really important to me.
And there is that sense. I know I even downloaded an app on my smartphone that supposedly, you know, you can hold it up and
yes,
it'll
yeah.
tell you what you're looking at. And what it does is remind me of what I don't know
yeah.
about what I'm looking
so that's
at.
That's the important thing, is to not be diminished by what you think you don't know, and to say, you know, I can take a step. For a while, I've had a project called Fairy Tale Moons, and what I've done is take traditional folk tales and fairy tales and connected them with the stars. So, for instance, Jack and the Beanstalk. Well, I like to tell that story under the full moon in the month of March, because this is when Orion, the great giant, is visible in both the northern and the southern hemisphere. And this is a pretty pervasive cultural tale about Jack and the giant. And so it gives that sense of, oh, I know that story, and oh, I can see those stars. And there's just a restorative feeling that is really important for us.
Now, we have a meteor shower coming up, correct?
Yes, yes, we do, the Perseids.
Tell us about some of the lore behind the Perseids.
Oh, gladly, I will. So a meteor shower typically takes its name from the constellation in front of which it appears to radiate. And so that's why we have the Perseids. It's named after the constellation Perseus. Now, this particular meteor shower, and actually most meteor showers that we experience, are caused by the fact that the Earth is passing through a trail of stuff that's left by the tail of a comet when it whizzes through our planetary system. So the parent comet for the Perseids has the name Swift-Tuttle. Now, that comet wasn't discovered until 1862. The story of the Perseids is coming from as far back as the 5th century BC.
Mm.
This particular comet has an orbital period of 133 years. So every 133 years, it's coming through and leaving more stuff. But it's really remarkable that it's always staying on the same path and that we move through that path at the same time every year. And what's happening, at least according to the ancient perspective, and we have to be really careful that we don't try to impose contemporary understanding on what was being witnessed by former cultures. It's pretty pervasive in former cultures that there was a belief that every individual human being comes from an individual star. So now we'll hear physicists say that, well, we're made of star stuff. It's not going quite as far as what the ancients said, which is that you come from a particular star, and it's possible to figure out that star and then read its journey as the kind of incarnation story of your coming to birth.
Hmm.
And when we look at the story behind the Perseid meteor shower, it really has to do with these birth mysteries. So he's born from a shower of golden stars. This is Zeus. Zeus sees the mother of Perseus. She's been confined to a brass-bound vault in the earth because her father, King Acrisius, he went to the oracle to find out when would he have a son. And the oracle says, as oftentimes oracles will, if you're trying to find out your future, it says to him, not only will you not have a son, but your daughter will have a son that will slay you. So he's frightened by this, and he confines his daughter in this brass-bound vault in the earth, and Zeus happens by, and seeing her there, confined, he transforms himself into a shower of golden stars and rains down on her, and that's how she gets pregnant with Perseus. The name Perseus means of Zeus, per Zeus.
Ah.
And so this relationship to the showering stars and Perseus has existed since the beginning of storytelling about this region of the sky. And I think one of the most remarkable things about it historically is that while that story starts to show up around the 5th century B.C., that Perseus is born from a shower of golden stars, it predates the Christian story of the single star over the birth of the Christ child by almost 500 years. So this is a really remarkable coincidence that demonstrates a kind of a developing idea, you could say, without trying to be offensive, but that the stars are intimately connected with birth processes on the Earth. And then from the Perseids, at the middle of August, we have the beginning of the meteor shower season that includes the Orionids that come in October, the Leonids that come in November, and then in December we have both the Geminids and the Ursids. So this last quarter of the year, just as we're getting ready to kind of sweep into fall and head toward winter solstice, we've got this meteor shower events happening month by month. And then when we get to winter solstice, that's when the constellation Perseus is highest up overhead. So it's really a beautiful harmony and symmetry in that.
And what better place to watch it would be the Headlands International Dark Sky Park and have you there explaining that as we're seeing the sky.
Yeah, I like to think so.
Mary Stewart Adams, Program Director at the Headlands International Dark Sky Park. It's in Emmett County. We have put a link to the park for more information for you to find out. It's on our website at michiganradio.org. Mary Stewart Adams, pleasure to talk with you. Thank you so much.
It was great being here. Thank you.
This is Stateside. I'm Cynthia Canty. His name is Matt Jones. He's 35, based in Ypsilanti. Matt Jones has been writing songs and performing around Michigan over the past 15 or so years, drawing a growing audience of fans and critics. And his story is one of making music and overcoming personal demons and finding salvation in the thing he loves best, which is making music.
On the trembling lips of age, 15 years are gone, I sing the same. The words have slowed their rumbling. I prefer you for got my name. Let me walk alone and let me swallow whole all the children whisper when they fall in love.
That's Matt Jones singing The Darkest Things. Matt joins us now in the studio. Good to meet you. Good to have you here at Stateside, Matt.
Definitely good to meet you.
Well, just to get started, I'm always interested in how an artist describes his or her music. So, Matt, what's your description of the music you make?
It's gone through a lot of changes, really. I would, you know, at times I've kind of felt like it was more along the classical lines, just with some pop vocals. Mm-hmm. I would have called it folk sometimes. Sometimes it's rock. So I'm really getting into synthesizers right now, so who knows where it's going to go next. But that's the hardest question there is. And as you start getting listeners, you find yourself to kind of ask them what you sound like.
Yes.
You know, you ask your audience, you know, what am I doing? What is this?
And what do you hear from them when you ask that?
There's some labels like indie folk, mm-hmm. just folk music. I mean, anytime somebody sees an acoustic guitar, it's folk music.
Matt Jones, you had to wrestle with some personal demons. Mm-hmm. You released an album in 2009, mm-hmm. and then came 2010, and what happened?
2009, an album came out, mm-hmm. and I think I really started to suffer a little bit from a little big fish in a little pond syndrome, okay. which can really tear you up.
That's interesting. Because you got a lot of critical praise for that first album.
Did a couple of tours and just felt like somehow because people liked it and then you start feeding off the sort of superficial relationships you have with people sometimes mm-hmm. in the right places or the wrong places. And you just kind of feel like you have a right to do anything. And one of those rights is to completely get self-destructive if you have to. Through alcohol, through, you know, bad diet, through stress, through, you know, financial problems, through drugs, through anything. And so, yeah, I don't know when that gets written into your constitution, but I know it's right after everybody starts saying how cool you are.
That's amazing that how that happened. So was 2010 pretty much kind of a lost year for you?
Right. It's completely lost. And one night I was pretty drunk, crashed my vehicle into a post mm-hmm. and then, you know, had to start going through the court system and things like that and like was on probation for a while and had a really tough PO and he just scared the bejesus out of me.
Which maybe was a good thing?
It was a good thing. It just helped me calm down and realize that I just need to learn how to live with things that can throw me off track.
How has that whole experience of having to fall apart, the wheels came off the wagon and you had to get up and put the wheels back on the wagon and get it back on track, how has that informed the songs you're writing now?
Well, the song, the newest song I have, The Darkest Things, that was, you know, I think when I was worrying all the time, when I was going a mile a minute all the time, I was trying to write songs that were the same way, just really stressed out songs, really complicated. It was like just math equations. And you know, watching it, you'd be like, wow, look at that guy. Look what that guy can play. Well, he can sing really high, you know, like, but the message wasn't there. And then one day, I was complaining to Misty, actually, about...
And Misty is?
Misty Lynn is, she sings with me in a band called The Reconstruction. Also sings with me a lot when we just play as a duo.
Okay.
And she has her own band called Misty Lynn and the Big Beautiful that I played drums with. And, but she was like, you know, why don't you just try writing a simple song? Why don't you just chill out and just write a simple melody? Give people a song they can take home, you know, and know... without having to consult a thesaurus what you're talking about. And so I did. I'm not sure how it came, but a melody came and then a simple chord progression came and I had to resist just twisting all those things into something really weird. But in the end, I had a song that was better, the best song I think I've ever had. So now... being the worrier that I am, I'm trying to figure out how to do it every time. And if I can't, I'm going to go crazy.
So that's the next mountain to come.
Yeah.
You're listening to Stateside on Michigan Radio. I'm Cynthia Canty. From musicians like Matt Jones, who are making their mark, to the latest in state politics, to conversations with local artists, we talk about all of it here on Stateside. Today, during the fall membership drive, we are asking you to help pay for the commercial-free programs, the programs that keep you in the know and keep you entertained. Please call 888-258-9866 with your gift of $10 or $15 a month, or maybe a one-time gift of any amount. It could be $5. It could be $5,000. It all helps to keep the shows you value on the air. Call now at 888-258-9866 or pledge online at michiganradio.org. And now here's Zoe Clark and Emily Fox to tell you more about the fall membership drive.